This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Readers were first introduced to Richard Ford's character, Frank Bascom, almost 30 years ago when The Sports Writer was published. Ford wrote about Bascom in Independence Day, that won a Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award, and in The Lay of the Land. In fact, Ford said after that book, he probably wouldn't be writing about Frank Bascom anymore. Well, that didn't happen. In his new book, Let Me Be Frank With You, Bascom has turned 68, is recently retired, feeling old, and still living in New Jersey. It's 2012, 2 weeks before Christmas and 2 months after Hurricane Sandy has devastated the Jersey Shore. Richard Ford wrote in the Financial Times that viewing what Sandy had done to the state's beach communities became a spark for these four interconnected stories. And Richard Ford, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been a long, long time.
Nice to see you, Marty. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks so much. I'd love to begin with a reading when Frank Bascom goes to the New Jersey Shore to see what Sandy has done.
Right. Seacliff, when I drive south on Central, gives to the world the sad look of having been taken a near-fatal punch in the nose. Power poles were mostly up, but lacking wires. Sand is eddied up over everything low down. Houses, even the now and then ones that look unscathed, seem stunned to stillness. Roofs, windows, front stoops, exterior wall, and garages, boats, shrink-wrapped in blue polypropylene, all look as if a giant has strode out of the gray sea and kicked the out of everything. Here are all places where people have lived. And not just smarty pants, fog-shuttered summer renters who stay 90 days past Memorial Day, but a sturdy core of old-time cliff dwellers, plus happy retirees alongside an older echelon of hedge fund coupon clippers who've bought in since the 70s and call it home. Each in his own way patronizes the pizzerias, the mom-and-pops, the car repairs, the Chinese takeouts, the fried seafood eateries where the TV's never off and the bar and the booth's always waiting. A bracing atmosphere of American faux egalitarianism long has reigned here, which drew me 2 decades back when I moved down from Haddam. I arrived when 700,000 still meant 700,000 and could buy you a piece of heaven. With my wife, Sally Caldwell, as my helpmate, I couldn't have been happier. All that life has now been poleaxed and strewn around like haystraw, so that even a hardened disaster tourist who sees opportunity in everything would have to ask himself, what can you do with this now? Let it settle back to nature. Walk away and come back in a year or 10. Move to Nova Scotia. Shoot yourself.
Richard Ford reading from his new book, Let Me Be Frank With You. I know that you and your wife actually went down to the New Jersey Shore shortly after Sandy devastated so much of those shore communities. Was that sort of your reaction to what you saw as
pretty,
well?
Pretty much it. We had been, Christina and I, my wife, New Orleanians a long time, and we were not there in New Orleans when Katrina occurred, but we were in Maine where we live. We came right back down there as soon as the storm happened and got busy working on the rebuild. And so I think long before I saw anything that had to do with Sandy, I had a lot of storage of stuff and memories and sights that were worth describing from Katrina.
It is amazing what a storm can do. I mean, just how it can move things around. I mean, make something look like a Hieronymus Bosch or a Dolly painting.
Right, right. All of these things that we consider to be permanent, the whole notion of real estate kind of goes away in a heartbeat.
It also, and this book is many ways about home or about people's, I mean, Frank lives in a home. The home that he had at the shore has been devastated by Sandy. His first wife is in a home for people who are ill. What does home mean to you?
Well, what home means to me is where somebody loves you, but that probably isn't the same thing that most people mean by home. I mean, home is obviously a variable term. I'm brought up in Mississippi, and there's some part of me that thinks that Mississippi is home, but there's another part of me that thinks, well, I didn't really have any choice about this. Right. I didn't choose Mississippi. I just happened to get born there. So how we define what is for ourselves home is an important piece of discretion that we have. And some people are willing to, concede that discretion to others, really. And I don't. Yeah. I mean, I guess in a way, Marty, I've sort of given up on the notion of home as a piece of terrain, and more just as a place where, again, where my wife is, really.
Well, as you say, and the book is dedicated to her. I mean, yeah. It seems like so much of your life has been. It's been possible because of your wife.
Completely. I mean, when we were kids, Christina and I have been together 50 years. I met her when she was 17 and I was 19. And I had, at the time, was joining the Marine Corps and was in law school. And none of that worked out for me. And so I had this crazy notion that I'd try to be a writer. And I said to her one morning, just before we got married in 1968, I said, you know what? I said, I think I'm going to maybe try to be a writer. And I could just as easily have said I was going to be a small engine repairman. And she said, oh, good. She said, do that. That's a really good idea. I'll get a job and you stay home and work. And by God, that's what we've done for 50 years.
Wow. You picked the right woman.
Boy, did I not. Did I not get lucky?
You've said this before because you've been interviewed a lot on this book about the idea that Frank Bascom, you thought maybe you were done with him.
Yeah.
But it sounded like on your last book tour, people kept asking about him.
It was very flattering and very affecting. And people would come up to me when I was running around the country with my novel Canada and say, is it really true? Aren't you, couldn't you do this again? That's not a reason to write a book, but it's also nothing to ignore.
Yeah.
Because what that means is that there's a use that people can make for a book. I mean, I'm just at an age in my life when I think if I write a book, I'm 70, if I write a book, it ought to be one that somebody can make use out of, not just write it because maybe I can. And those people actually made me think about something that, as you say, I hadn't thought about before.
Well, but you've done a lot to this character to try to get rid of him. He got shot two times.
Right.
He got prostate cancer.
Yes.
I mean, you've made life tough for Frank Bascom.
There's nothing left but humor, Marty. This is a funny book for all of its gravity and being about grave subjects. It means to subscribe to the old comics injunction that if nothing's funny, nothing's serious.
Oh, interesting. You had some interesting things to say in, I think it was the Financial Times. You wrote here, a writer's relationship to his character isn't much like a relationship one has with a real person. For instance, Frank's not my child. I'm not fond of children, nor is he my alter ego. I'm not sure what an alter ego even is. He's not my buddy. He's not me in disguise. He doesn't speak for me. He may be my secret friend, but only in ways that children have secret friends. But it is interesting to have a character that has, in a sense, been with you for, what, 20, 30 years
longer
now.
Oh, gee, it's great, as a matter of fact. But it's peculiar nature, that character's peculiar nature needs to be limbed out, because most of the way in which people ask you, is it like this or is it like that, it ain't. It's really... it's a source of language is what it is.
What do you mean?
I mean, when I'm always writing stuff down in my notebook, and sometimes I write things down in my notebook, and I know that would be a line that Frank Bascom could think or say or describe something that he could do. So really what it is for me, it's much more ephemeral than a person or being like a person. It's really language. And Frank is for me a source of language, and his embodiment as a piece of fiction is language.
He's 68 years old. As you said, you're 70 years old. It seems like he feels old. He feels...
Well, I think when you're 68, however you feel old. That's what feeling... But, I mean, I'm 70.
You feel old?
I feel great. I mean, that's not
good. Well, see, I think a lot of people feel...
But that's what it means. But that's what it means to be 68. However you feel when you're 68, it's how it feels to be 68. I mean, you can feel like hell. You can hurt. You know what they say, if I wake up in the morning and nothing hurts, I'm dead, but you can also feel a lot of other ways. So there's no template for how you're supposed to feel when you get to be 68. And plus, lots of people are a lot older than 68 and 70 and are doing great. So when you say someone feels old, then that's where fiction comes in, because we have to ferret out what that actually means.
Well, I'm in my 60s, and what
you are not.
Yes, I am. But I feel is mortal.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had neighbors who have died. I have friends who have died. I have relatives who have died. You do feel that life is finite.
Yeah, but it's and then once you feel that way, there are a lot of other discretions that you have. I mean, I feel that way. I had a cancer operation about 7 or 8 years ago, which then turned out after 3 or 4 days not to be a cancer operation, and I what I felt was interested. I felt, gee, this. I better start doing stuff here if I'm going to have this. So it didn't scare me. But again, there wasn't any template for how to feel. You just feel how you feel and try to make the most of it. I was lucky because I got to have it and then not have it.
Exactly.
2 or 3 days later.
Yeah, really.
But in the
really.
Days that I thought I had it, I had it.
Well, it's interesting because Frank Bascom wants to shed words. I mean, there's certain words he just says, you know, they got to go. There's time for these words to go. As a writer, are there certain words that you're sick of, or you just feel like, okay, you have served your time?
Well, I think as a citizen, there are lots and lots of words that filter into our brain and out again that we would like to hear less of. Right. I mean, a lot of these words turn up on the media.
Yes.
But a lot of them are just floating around the world. I mean, you know, I have students, and I've had students in good universities all my life who are constantly using the word like. Now, I would like to take like out of their vocabulary. Right. I say to them sometimes, I said, you know, you're getting a degree from Columbia University. Do you really want to go out into the world and sound like a moron?
Oh, is that what it sounds like to you?
Yeah. Yeah, because words are leaving your mouth unbidden. Words are leaving your mouth unmediated by intelligence. And it would be nice if we could just get a little closer to what we actually want to say and get some of that roughage out of there.
Well, I know from having interviewed you before, you had a pretty serious case of dyslexia as a kid growing up. I don't know if you outgrow dyslexia or you just learned to manage it or work around it.
In my case, that.
That. But also whether that makes you more protective of language.
I'm sure it does. I read very slowly.
Do you?
Yeah. And because I read very slowly, I think I pore over words a lot more than most people. All of words' corporeal qualities I have access to, rather than just seeing a word and thinking of its definition, seeing a word as a window. I don't see words as windows. I see words as things that have shapes that look a certain way on the page, that have a sound associated with them, that have syncopation. So that probably makes me a little bit more of a magister over language than most people would be. But that's fine. I mean, I think most of the fiction that I write has to do with people saying things to other people and not being understood properly and not being taken in. Whereas if we could use the language a little more felicitously, a little more carefully, maybe that wouldn't happen as much.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Richard Ford is our guest. He has a new book. It's really a collection of 4 interconnected stories about featuring and narrated by his well-known and beloved character, Frank Bascom. And the book is called Let Me Be Frank With You. We're going to do another reading after the short break, carry on our conversation, and open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Richard Ford about his new book and about writing. We'll be talking about his life as well. And I'd love to have you read another section from your new book.
This is from the first story called I'm Here. It's not true that as you get older, things slide away like molasses off a tabletop. What is true is I don't remember some things that well, owing to the fact that I don't care all that much. I now wear a cheap Swatch watch, but I do sometimes lose the handle on the day of the month, especially near the end and the beginning when I get off track about 30 days after September. This, I believe, is normal and doesn't worry me. It's not as if I put my trousers on backwards every morning or tie my shoelaces together, or I can't find my way to the mailbox. My only persistent bother is an occasionally painful subluxation, a keeper word, in my C3 and C4. It causes me to feel Rice Krispies in my neck, plus an ache when I twist back and forth, so that I don't do that as much. I fear it may be restricting signals to my brain. My orthopedist had had a medical, Dr. Zippy, a Pakistani and a prime nitwit, asked if I wanted him to order up some blood work to find out if I'm a candidate for Alzheimer's. It made him gleeful to suggest this. Thanks, but I guess not, I said, standing in his tiny green cubicle in a freezing-ass flower print examination gown. I'm not sure what I'd do with the information. You'd probably forget it, he said, gloating. He's also told me that usually unobserved vertical crease down the earlobe is a good marker for heart disease. I, of course, have one, though it isn't deep, which I hope is a positive sign.
And again, Richard Ford reading from his new book, Let Me Be Frank With You. I mean, there is a lot of humor in this book, but also... And I don't know whether Frank has just gotten to a certain age or you just sort of don't care what people think anymore.
Maybe Richard's gotten to that age.
Or maybe Richard Ford has gotten to that age. I mean, sometimes that comes with age, right?
Well, I think in Frank's case, he's reached an age when he cares about the things he cares about a lot and doesn't care about the things he used to try to have to care about as much. Mm-hmm. It's probably that. I mean, this is a book about subtracting things from your life so you can do the other things that you know you want to do, love the person you want to love, have something to do with mm-hmm. your kids in a way that satisfies you instead of all this sort of diffusing of life to an unmemorable mass.
There was a piece about you in the New Yorker. I'm scrambling for a piece of paper here where you said that you think Frank is a nicer man than you are.
Can't
demonstrably.
Can't you tell?
No, I can't, as a matter of fact. But do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do think it's true. I mean, I don't think Frank is vindictive, which I am.
Are you?
Oh, sure.
You hold grudges?
Oh, absolutely. If you wrong me, I wrong you. If I can, sure. Uh-huh.
So far, so good, though, right?
So far, so good. But, you know, I grew up in a family of boxers and sort of rough and tumble. My family, particularly on my mother's side, really pretty rough and tumble people. Mm. So if you got a whack, you gave a whack. I know that's not politically
that's okay.
appropriate anymore, but...
but you feel it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you haven't, like, actually punched someone in the nose.
Not recently. I am 70 years old. Sometimes you punch somebody in the nose, you're 70 years old. You're probably going to punch you.
Exactly. Frank says he's a member of the Clean Desk demographic, free to do unalloyed good in the world. And he does good in the world.
He
reads blind people. He meets soldiers at Newark Airport. Do you think of retirement? I mean, as a writer, do you feel like you at some point you need or must or have to retire?
Well, I would rather have the say-so over that decision rather than have some book reviewer tell me I should have quit two books ago. So I don't think as a vocation rather than a profession that as a vocation you are promised to be able to do this at a high level forever. And so it wouldn't be alien to me to look around and say, well, maybe I've done this enough. Maybe I have done this the best I can do it, and I'm still alive. I've still got some life to live. Maybe I could do something more useful with the time. Because I think that writing books for me is making things which other people can use. It has a benefit for others. And if I thought I didn't have that benefit, you know, when those people ask me on my book tour, would I write another Baskin book? I thought, well, one of the things they're saying to me is that we might have a use for that. Some young man came up to me in a book signing line the other day and said he had given this book to all of his groomsmen in his wedding. And I thought, gee, that's awfully nice. You know,
that wanted
to start off life in that way. So books, not just my books, all kinds of books, all kinds of pieces of imaginative literature, find uses out in the world.
Is it hard for you to write, or does it sort of depend on the day or the time of day or what you're working on?
Writing is easy.
Writing is easy?
You know, when you find writers who tell you that they really work really hard, you should grab your wallet.
Oh, really? I've interviewed a lot of writers that say that.
Well, shame on them. You know, they're just trying to convince their mom and their daddy that they have a job.
But for you, it's easy?
Well, it's not hard.
It's not.
Sometimes it's a little arduous when you have a novel that has 200,000 words in it, and you are dyslexic, as I am, and you have to get all those words in their precise right places. That can get a little tiresome. But the actual doing of things, sitting at your desk with a pen, writing things down, thinking about how you're going to make something good and make it good for others, no, that's not hard.
You know, had you read, and I want to have you read another section a little bit later in the hour, had you read two sections, as someone with dyslexia, are you sort of decoding as you read? I mean, you wrote this, so it's not like you're reading someone else's writing, but I'm just curious about the process of reading, even as a seven-year-old.
Well, I think you were reading along with a couple of those.
I was.
Well, you saw that I probably changed a word or
you
two.
You did.
I did, yeah. I don't even know it.
Oh, you don't even see it?
No, I hear it after I do it, but I don't know it when I do it. And this it's likewise with almost everything. Mm. I remember Christina and I I was reading this.
That's your wife.
Independence Day to her aloud, and I was describing something on the Jersey Turnpike. And I read this long passage, and she said, you know, sweetheart, she said, you said the blue sulfur lights, she said, but it really is orange here on the page.
Oh.
And I'm just constantly revising things in my head against often what is there on the page. And I think that's one of the definitions of dyslexia, which is that your eyes track across things on the page, and what actually shows up in your brain can be a little different. And sometimes if you have it severely, very different or not at all.
And you had it pretty severely, right?
Well, I would say I did not have it severely, because if I had it severely, I probably wouldn't be here.
Oh, really?
I mean, I think I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I had it just severely enough to slow everything down, which was a benefit to me. I don't think all people with dyslexia have that choice.
Mm-hmm. But slowing it down, you get to sort of hear all the – I mean, I like the Rice Krispies in his neck,
right.
But you get to hear all the various sounds within a word.
And you also gain governance over the words that you're writing down. I mean, the reading and writing are gestures which are related, certainly in my mind. And one of the things that authorship means is – governance over the words that you put on the page. It very much relates to what we were talking about, excluding words from the vocabulary that are hollowed out, that no longer have any cognition associated with them.
Just sort of words
like.
Yes, like.
And a lot of other ugly words, too.
Well, you don't like soft landing, sibs, bond, hydrate, make art, share, reach out, noise, and...
Well, these
Some
are words
others.
That we've all just trampled into the ground. I mean, how many times have I heard someone say, oh, thanks for sharing that with me? I always think to myself, I didn't share that with you. I just told you something. Or someone will say, let me reach out to someone.
Yes.
Reach out for me really in its origins has a very different connotation. So reach out just now means make a phone call to. I don't like that.
Right. Are you on Twitter? And
I am not.
Are you on Facebook?
I am not.
And no, with no desire? I mean, does that world interest you at all?
Not at all.
Not at all?
No. And which is kind
it's
of
too ephemeral, or it's...
It's unnecessary. Oh. I mean, it's driven by... It's made to seem essential to us, except it's just driven by commerce. And the fact that it's only driven by commerce and that the commerce makes it essential to us is to me, makes it suspect. Not to say that other people wouldn't feel different or shouldn't feel different. We're just talking about me here.
Sure.
I think I'm going to get out of life without ever Twittering anybody. Was that tweet? That's what it is, isn't it?
Somewhat.
I don't even know how to...
That's
know.
A word you don't have here, by the way.
I don't know how to text. I don't know how to do that.
Well, you do know how to write, and Richard Ford is our guest, and he has a new book. It's called Let Me Be Frank With You. And for those of you that read The Sports Writer and Independence Day and also The Lay of the Land, it does feature Frank Bascom, a very memorable and fascinating and obviously enduring character that has now showed up in four of Richard Ford's books. And we do have a tweet.
Oh.
Speaking of tweets, we have a tweet from Dawn. She says, love this guy.
It's my first
there
tweet.
You go. Listening to him read is terrific. Reminds me of Nikki Finney. And if I can give a shout out to Dawn, Nikki Finney is a poet at the University of Kentucky, won the National Book Award a couple of years ago,
nice.
And was a guest on this show. And is, in fact, you would like her poetry because it has many of the things that I associate with the South.
Oh, is that so?
Yes. Yeah. And stories. And anyway, I think that's a compliment.
Well, that's
to you.
Very. I take it
your
as
very first tweet.
Pretty much all of my teachers were poets when I was in school. Yeah, Galway Connell, Donald Hall. They taught me what sentences were.
Oh. Did you ever think of being a poet yourself?
Not one moment in my life.
Wouldn't have worked for you?
Wouldn't have interested me.
No.
I think I probably just have more stuff going on in my head.
I do want to have you read another section from the book. And Frank visits several people. One of them is I'll tell you where it is, of his first wife, actually. This is on page 138. And it ends on 139. Anne, though, is getting her money's worth. Where Frank is, it's in the middle of the page there, Frank, on 138. Frank is visiting his first wife, who is in the hospital. Yes, Anne, though, is getting her money's worth. Do you see that there?
She's in an old folks' home, really, very expensive one. Anne, though, is getting her money's worth out here, just happy as a goldfish about it. Carnage Hill advertises anything but preclusive. On display in the foyer is their platinum certificate from the Federation of Coaxial Senior Life is a Luxury Few Want to Leave Society, based in Dallas, the National Death Savvy Research Center. The goal at Carnage Hill is to rebrand aging as a to-be-looked-forward-to phenomenon. Thus, no one working inside wears a uniform, smart, soft color, soft to the touch, casual wear is supplied from Land's End. No one's called staff or treated like it. Instead, alert, friendly, well-dressed, well-groomed strangers just seem to happen by, acting interested and offering to help whoever needs it. Half of the caregivers are Asian, who are better at that type of thing than Anglo-Saxons, Negroes, and regular Italian Jerseyites. Everything inside is sustainable, solar, green, run by sensors, paperless or hands-off, and is pricey beyond imagining. Loaner Priuses are available in an underground geo-heated garage. Wireless pillboxes inform residents when to take their meds. Computer games and the TVs chart residents' cognitive baseline if they can remember to play. There are even internet cemeteries that invite residents to make videos of themselves so loved ones can see Aunt Ola when she still had a brain. Aging is a multidisciplinary experience, the corporate brochure muses, wants applicants to know. Carnage Hill, following the theme, is thus a living laboratory for gray Americans.
Again, Richard Ford reading from his book. I love the fact that this old folks' home, which is so green and politically correct, is called Carnage Hill.
Well, that's something I actually made up. You know?
I know. I figured there couldn't be a Carnage Hill.
No, there couldn't be. But you know, I lived a long time in central New Jersey. As you know, in central New Jersey, there are a lot of strange names for places. Plus, this is a made-up place.
Yes, of course.
All that other stuff, all of those facility improvements in the home itself, you can't make that stuff up.
Yeah.
That comes right out of my, so to speak, research.
Well, have you visited friends or family in places like Carnage Hill?
Well, once my mother was ill and she was supposed to go into Presbyterian Village in Little Rock where she lived, and we took her in there and I could just see the blood drain out of her face, and she basically said,
I'm not doing this,
and she walked back out and pretty much gave up the whole effort right there and died about 2 weeks later. I think the prospect for her was not good. On the other hand, I visited a place in New York, a high rise full of people over 90, and gave a long talk to them one afternoon. It was the happiest place I've ever seen in my life. And this guy came up to me and said, "You're 70." He said, "You could live here."
Would you want to?
No.
No? You want to do what your mom did?
Yeah, I want to do what my mom did, of course.
Well, in this chapter, Frank is visiting his first wife. He has a second wife who works as a social worker.
Yes.
But he's bringing his first wife a very, very fancy pillow.
Yes, indeed.
Why a pillow?
Because it's an orthopedic pillow designed in Switzerland for people who have Parkinson's disease early onset, and because it's, apparently with people who are early onset Parkinson's, they don't sleep well, mm-hmm. and that not sleeping well creates stress, which makes the symptoms of Parkinson's a little more severe. So it was an attempt to make her less stressful and sleep better, so her Parkinson's could be endured.
Well, and she believes, or kind of believes, that her Parkinson's could have caused Hurricane Sandy.
Well,
or there was some connection between the two.
There's a little nuttiness there.
Is a little nuttiness
yeah,
there,
that's right.
Or grandiosity, yeah, or something.
Yeah, but she's into New Age remedies for things in which all things that are connected to ourselves are somehow connected to the universe. And it's just Frank doesn't believe this. It should be said.
Yeah,
and I'm not
yeah.
sure that when I wrote it for Anne that I imagined that she really believed it. She just said it.
Does he love her, his first wife?
You know, I think if you ever love somebody, you always love them. So, yeah, of course. Yeah. He just doesn't want to have anything to do with her.
Right, and she moves kind of close to where he's living in New Jersey.
Right. Yeah.
And his daughter has a phone conversation basically saying, you got to suck it up, Dad.
Yeah. You know, she's dying. She gets to make the choices where she wants to live. She'd been living on the shore in Jersey, and her husband died. And so when she had this Parkinson's diagnosis, she moves back to central Jersey into Haddam, where they had lived when they were young married. It's really not very implausible.
Yeah, yeah. And you lived in Princeton for a while. I mean,
I
New
did.
Jersey, obviously, very much part of these Bascom novels.
It made a huge impression on me when my sports writing career crashed and burned about 1981. I came back to New Jersey and I'd written two novels and nobody had read them. So I thought, what could I do? My wife said, well, why don't you write a novel about somebody who's happy? You hadn't done that yet. So I looked around and I thought, what is it? I'm living in central New Jersey. What is it that could make me happy? What, and my character happy? And I thought central New Jersey could make you happy if you just decide it's going to. Because again, it's about taking governance over things, taking sovereignty over your circumstances. And actually, when you look at New Jersey, it looks like a microcosm of the United States.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Richard Ford is our guest. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, and he has a new book. It's called Let Me Be Frank With You. And for those of you that read some of his other books, it features his character, Frank Bascom. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Richard Ford, and much to the joy of many of his fans, he brought his fictional character, Frank Bascom, back to life. Frank, the narrator of three of Ford's previous novels, including his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Independence Day, is an everyman kind of guy. And in this new book, Let Me Be Frank With You, he's recently retired from his job selling real estate in New Jersey, and it all takes place shortly after Hurricane Sandy and just a couple of weeks before Christmas. And I'm talking with Richard Ford about this character, this book, a bit about his life as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY. Do you think of Frank Bascom as an everyday kind of guy? I don't know. I struggle to describe him myself.
I do. I don't think of him as an everyman. Because I don't know what an everyman is. I mean, novels are all full of particulars, and I spend my days writing him, trying to make him be as particularized as I can, and not cause him to radiate into some conceptual notion of what a man is. So no, I don't think of him as an everyman, but I do think of him as normal. I think if you met Frank Bascom, if that could happen on the street, you would think here's a guy I get.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't seem exotic. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't seem alienated. He wouldn't seem isolated. Sometimes when you narrate a book in the first person, as these books are narrated in the first person, the fact of that formal decision causes the character to seem somewhat on the outside looking in, causes him or her to seem somewhat isolated. In fact, I don't think of him that way at all.
Mm.
He just tells his own story, which ipso facto seems to cause him to be isolated, which he isn't, I don't think.
In one of the chapters, an African-American woman is knocking on his door as he's coming home. And as it turns out, this is a house that he's living in that she grew up in.
Yes.
And I have to say that Frank seems very uncomfortable around African-Americans and calls them Negroes.
Yes.
Which is a very...
Is a what? I want to hear the next word out of your
mouth. I was going to say a very 20th century word.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
It's a 20th century word. Dr. King used it.
Yes.
It's certainly not meant in any way in Frank's voice or in my usage. It's not meant in any way derogatory.
Right.
But
feels old-fashioned to me. I mean, if maybe because it's
the reason I used it, because okay. It places him as a guy who was born in 1945 and has lived on into his 70s now, and so it's still current. But I mean, it's kind of hard for him to keep up with modern lingo.
Yeah,
and so that's a word he uses with some confidence. But again, I hasten to say, not in a derogatory sense.
But do you think he is? I mean, it is an unusual situation. Someone's knocking on your door and says, you know, I used to live in this house, and you invite them in. But do you think he is uncomfortable?
I think he is self-conscious about race. I don't think he's uncomfortable about race. I think he's self-conscious and is wanting to do the right thing and is also wanting somehow to be himself. And he's a little bit whipsawed between those two impulses, which I think happens to a lot of not just white people around black people. It happens to people around somebody different from them who they want to respect all the time.
I mean, we can tell from your voice, you grew up in the South. I mean,
yeah.
You grew up in Mississippi.
I did.
And you're 70, so you were born in the 40s and lived in a...
Through the Freedom Riders.
Through the Freedom Riders, the segregated South.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I never went to school with a black child. I never had a date with a black woman. I didn't play sports against black kids. I mean, it could, you know... That was horrible for them, for that apartheid system, for the African Americans. It was kind of horrible for us white kids too, because it made life just be a big lie, and life seemed quite absurd, because here was the state telling you that there's another race of people across on the other side of town who are not equal to you, who you can't associate with, who you can't socialize with, who you can't respect. It made white life in that way ridiculous.
Did you feel that as a kid growing up?
I felt it increasingly. It felt it increasingly, which is why when I had the opportunity, I got the hell out of Dodge and went to school in Michigan in 1962.
Because
I was on the wrong side of it. I was to be a white Southerner in Mississippi in 1962, I was on the wrong side.
I ran across a quote, I believe you said this, that you were not an ideological racist. I mean, you didn't believe in that, but perhaps just to use some of the vernacular.
I was a get-along. I was a go-along kid trying to fit myself in until I realized by the time I was getting out of high school, I was not succeeding fitting myself in. I wasn't a hater. My parents weren't racists. But in that environment, which is the environment of high school, it was part of the deal. It was part of the way the school was set up that it was segregated. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while to figure it out. I'm a slow learner. I'm slow at everything.
Your father died when you were, what, 16?
16.
16 years old.
In my arms.
In
died
your arms?
In my arms.
In he had his, a heart attack, right?
He did, right.
Had he been ill?
Well, he'd had other heart problems. You know, what my father died of in 1962, had he lived 5 years longer, he wouldn't have died of. He had a what they used to call a heart murmur. And now we know what that is. It's a mitral valve that needs to be replaced. And if he'd lived 5 more years, it could have been replaced. And so he would have had a chance to live. Yeah.
But he died in your arms.
He did. He did. Yeah. I wrote about this, actually, in the New York Times after 9/11. He had, in a way, I mean, it was terrible that he died, terrible for him, terrible for my mother and me. But unlike those people in 9/11, he had the luxury of dying in his son's arms.
Yes.
At home.
Yeah.
So as terrible as it was, it could have been worse.
And so your mom, I mean, she was a single mother. You're an only child, right?
Yes,
I
am.
I don't like the term only child.
I do.
Do you?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Because it means I got everything.
Well, that is true.
Good, bad.
I'm
not a great sharer to this day. I don't like the word. Let me share this with you.
Oh, interesting. Were you spoiled?
No, I wasn't spoiled. Both of them were very volatile, my parents, and they had big tempers. So I was not spoiled. I mean, maybe all first and only children get spoiled to some extent because they get all of their parents' attention. But getting all of your parents' attention has some downsides to it.
Did your mom have to struggle to kind of pay the rent and
all of
that kind of
stuff? Yes, she did. But her parents were alive and they had some dough.
Right.
So they helped her out. And I'd always worked from the time I was 13. I had jobs. It wasn't because they made me. I just wanted to have some money, and what they were giving me as my little allowance wasn't quite getting it for me.
Yeah.
So as soon as I could get out of the house and go to work, I got out of the house and went to work.
What kind of jobs?
Oh, all the usual. So sacking groceries and just whatever, you know, nothing with a career potential for me.
But across the street was Eudora Welty. She was your neighbor across the street.
Well, her house was my neighbor across the street. She had moved away in 1928. We moved into this house in 1943.
Oh.
In fact, when we lived there on North Congress Street, I didn't know that Eudora was Eudora. I didn't know that her family had resided in that house. We went to the same school, which was next door. We had the same, if you can believe this, she was 35 years older than I. We had the same teachers.
Wow.
If you can think of that. It's kind of a different notion of teacher career.
Yeah, exactly. Many
years
into
later.
Into their 70s, 80s maybe.
Many worked that line. And many years later, she and I attended a reunion for the school we went to. And in the front row, this would have been about 1988, in the front row was Miss Luella Varnado, who had been her teacher and been my teacher and was at that time 101 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did you have teachers that thought, you know, Richard, maybe you could write? Or
No.
I mean,
no.
There was no evidence that you had a talent for this?
No. Yeah, it was just crowd control, basically. I had one really wonderful English teacher who taught me how to write sentences, not imaginative sentences, but sentences that were clear. She did teach me that, Mrs. Rosemary Thompson, and she just passed away, in fact, just this last year. No, there wasn't any thought of that. I was dyslexic. I was troublesome. I was in trouble all the time with the police, in trouble all the time, in the principal's office. I was just one of those kind of kids. Yeah.
Bad trouble or mischievous trouble?
No, bad trouble.
Okay.
Bad trouble.
Steal
cars, break into houses, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we did that. But we were just little suburban punks. It isn't as if we even needed the stuff that we stole. We just did it to see if we could. But it got me in a peck of trouble.
I bet.
And the guy I did it with went to prison. And so I was headed in that way. In fact, if my father hadn't died when he died and my mother hadn't come into my room and said to me, Richard, you know, your daddy's dead. You just can't do this anymore because I'm here taking care of you now. I can't come down to the juvenile court with you again and cry in front of the judge and get you off. This isn't, that somehow made an impression on me.
And that was the end of your criminal career?
I think we can say it ended there, yes.
Yeah. I mean, just one of those...
sort of epiphanic moments in which you see, you know, I can't do this again. I mean, we all wish that those moments would come more often than they do relative to a lot of the things we'd like not to do again. But that was one for me, for sure.
So was it the thrill of breaking into people's houses?
Yes, absolutely.
And just, you know, hoping you could get away with it?
Absolutely.
Get out the door before they come running down the stairs,
absolutely.
That kind of thing?
I'm sure great criminal careers have commenced precisely in that way. I mean, there was no malice in my heart, but there was malice in my acts.
So what would you take?
Well, hunting rifles and steal cars and leave them places. And you know, it was a kind of pranksterism that the police don't think of as pranksterism when they get you in the car.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So you were well known in the court.
Unfortunately, yes, I was.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a little better known than I would have liked.
And this your partner in crime did end up
He went to
the serious stuff, more violent type stuff? Or?
I think he was probably put in the slam for growing marijuana when he came back from Vietnam. But he went to Parchman, which means something. If you're from Mississippi and you go to Parchman,
that's serious time.
That's a place you don't want to go. It's the Mississippi equivalent of Angola.
So that's hard time.
It's a work farm. and it is not a happy place.
You also went for time in law school. I mean,
I did.
You fancied yourself thinking?
I didn't fancy myself. I prospered in law school, but
That seems like a hard. If you're dyslexic, I just can't imagine reading all those law books.
But by that time, though, Marty, I was hard to it. I had figured out what I needed to do, that I couldn't have any other life outside of reading those books. And as you say, it was hard going, but I did it, I prospered there. But I was in love, and my girlfriend was living in New York, and I was living in St. Louis, and I knew somebody was going to snap her off one of these days when I wasn't looking, and I'm sure I was right. So I just made a kind of an executive decision after a while. I said, I just can't stay down here learning to be a lawyer because, A, this isn't very much fun, and, B, I'm going to lose the one person in the world I care about.
Wow.
Who I'm married to this day.
Where did you meet her? I mean, how did you find this wonderful woman?
When she was 17 and I was 19 at Michigan State.
I mean, was it
a busboy in her dormitory?
Oh.
Yeah.
And was it love at first sight?
Yes.
For you? For her?
For me. I can't speak for her. Right. She would probably say yes, but I would have to let her do that.
You've learned not to speak for her, right?
I've learned not to speak for her. She's a big deal. Yeah. She can speak for herself. We didn't have any children. I think that's probably one of the reasons life has been as enduring as it has. Mm. Whenever we had arguments, we could have them all right then. You know, whenever,
not wait till the kids go to bed.
Not wait till the kids go to bed. Whenever we could always say what we thought. And if she had a job, she was the head of city planning for the city of New Orleans for quite a long time. It was a job I learned to hate. And at a certain point, I had to go live in France for a while. But if you got kids, you can't do that. Dad just can't go live in France for a while. But we could do that and reconvene.
You weren't worried about someone stealing her while you were in France?
I was always worried about that. But, you know, you can't, to make a long marriage survive, you can't be each other's wardens. And we have not been each other's wardens.
So lots of room?
Lots of room.
You live in Maine now in a tiny little town.
A tiny little village of about 300 people, East Booth Bay, Maine, which is a boat building town and a lobster ring town. And it balloons up in the summers, of course, as Maine does. And happily, we're happy when these people come, and we're happy when they go back home because they come and have a good time. And they help the economy. But it's a tiny little place. We live right on the ocean. We've lived there for 15 years.
How did you find this place?
Just how else, Marty? With a real estate agent.
With Frank Bascom. Yeah. All right, your real
these
estate agent.
These things don't circle too far from the middle, you know. Right. The day I bought that house in East Booth Bay, I had never been in that town before. I knew not a soul, but I liked the house. And I thought it would be a house where Christina and I could be happy, and it has proved to be such.
Because?
Because it's by the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little bit isolated. And Maine, from community to community to community, you can't generalize about it. But we hit on a good one. Booth Bay is an extremely accepting town for people from away.
Oh. And Not all small towns are.
No, they're not. I mean, there are towns in Maine that are noted for not being friendly. Booth Bay's just not one of them.
Yeah.
It's really a good one. And people know I'm a writer, but I never worry about whether anybody's read any of my books. They make any difference to me. I hope they do, and I hope they like them. But if they don't, we're going to be friends anyway.
Well, it's been such a pleasure, Richard Ford.
Nice
and thank
to see you
so much to have you back on Radio Times. Thanks so
Real
much.
Real pleasure.
And again, Richard Ford, our guest. His newest book, his most recent book called Let Me Be Frank With You. And we have been talking about it, and again, featuring his character, Frank Bascom, who he has written about in some other books as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out about this program, including our newsletter and how to find us on Facebook and Twitter, and also how to download a podcast of the show. Richard Ford probably doesn't know what I am talking about. Adam Stanishevsky, our engineer for this edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.